The world has gone insane. Cosplayers rule the conventions. Gamers dominate the tabletop and the internet. Sci-fi subjugates the movies, and fantasy rules the bookstore with an iron fist. Only one group can bring order to this unruly mob. A team of uber geeks, masters of the nerdly arts, trained for decades in the hobby shops and basements of the nation. Mobilized by the secret masters, they are the Department of Nerdly Affairs.
Hello, operatives, and welcome to the Department of Nerdly Affairs. I'm your host, Rob Patterson, here with my co-host, Don Chisholm.
Sure.
And tonight, by the power of Grayskull, we shall be talking about strength in North American media, and just kind of media in general. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about depictions of strength. What does it mean to be strong? What does it mean to be weak? What is strong? We're going to talk about it all. But first, Don, tell me, what does it mean to be strong?
See, this is kind of the, it's one of them questions that everybody's already answered, but they don't realize they've ever asked.
Okay.
And I think this comes up, we've talked about, the idea that in North American entertainment, we don't typically like to see our heroes at a loss.
Okay. Why not?
Well, this is the difficulty in answering the question is, what is it about the North American psyche that makes us want our hero to just be the big, massive, kick-ass guy right from the beginning?
Right.
Because we've talked about how, say, when you get to, like, the Japanese stuff, almost always the hero is a schmo at the beginning of the series. And what the story is you're watching them become somebody important, become somebody, like, strong, powerful, focused, somebody who contributes to the setting in some way, usually by beating up a bad guy.
Of course.
And here it's always, if we do have a hero who starts out weak, they're always the chosen one. So we're reassured right at the beginning, nah, this guy's gonna, like, kick all the ass and stuff. We just have to get through the boring montage first.
So in a way, we like all our characters to be superheroes.
Yeah, that's to one degree or another. Yeah, I think that's
Okay, I'm wondering about that. I mean, so that would mean then that in a way, basically, we're still telling, like, the great mythical stories pretty much about all our characters, or at least all our characters in most popular media.
Yep.
Now, do you think that that's because of something in, say, the male psyche or something? Or, I mean, is there something there that we are drawn to figures of strength, maybe for reasons that we want to be that person? Like, we admire strength in our society and that strong, independent spirit. So therefore, we're drawn to figures of strength, almost on a wish fulfillment level.
I think there is. When you say the male angle, you're kind of asking a loaded statement, but we can get back to that. Because I think one of the things that happens, and again, it's this idea that entertainment doesn't just shape society, it's a reflection of it.
Right.
I think in North America, you started to see some changes that happened. I think it starts back in the 60s.
Because the 60s.
Dynaman reference, 10 points. But
yep, there it is.
And you playing at home, if you've got what a Dynaman reference is, that's 5 points for you.
Not you, Jack.
Anyway,
Jack didn't get it anyway. It doesn't matter.
We'll have to send him some discs.
Okay, that's true. Well, we can link. They're on YouTube.
That's true. I keep forgetting that because I'm old.
There we go. So, keep going. Sorry.
Okay, but what you get in the 60s, and everybody remembers rebellion, counterculture, all of that. You get this idea of the actualization of the individual. That tends to have a little more value. Not that it wasn't always theirs, because especially in the United States, here in Canada, we're a little bit different, but you always had that idea of the rugged individual. Like, that was the person who tamed the West, and that was the person who, like, established the railroad lines, and that was the person who got things done, was the big, powerful person at the top.
Right.
But you always also had that conflicting against the idea of the good of society being part of things. Like when you got to the 50s, that's one of the things that's funny to watch if you watch like education films or PSAs from that era. They're always about citizenship, and it's real easy to picture that the Borger behind the camera going, "Yes, we approve of this statement wholeheartedly." And that's one of the running jokes, like, the Bob Dobbs era suit tie, like necktie, pipe smoking dude. It comes from that image of conformity. The 60s, little different, little crazier, but you get that idea of the individual. Going into the 70s, you get, and the hair stands on the back of my neck every time I think of this, you got that idea of self-actualization taken to the next step. And there was good and bad. Like that was the thing that looms large in my nightmares often, was the free to be you and me movement.
I knew you were going to say that.
You probably, anybody who's listened to this show knows I was.
Yep.
But it's that idea of we're in another era of that now, of like, telling the kids that you can be anything and you're just inherently awesome, and all of that. It's swaying things, swaying attitudes more towards the individual. The 70s was also, not coincidentally, an era of like selfishness. You saw the real hardcore beginnings of rampant consumerism taking off during that era. It goes into the 80s. The 80s is when that's kind of like fully realized. And I think that that's sort of a lot of what we're living through now, I think, comes out of that 70s, 80s era.
Why do you think that? Why do you think that the 70s, 80s era has had such a strong influence even until today?
Well, part of it's because, like you always say, the people who were kids then are the movers and shakers now.
Ah, yes, that's true.
And that's, I think, part of it too is it goes with this idea of perfecting the formula. Because, like we said back in the Teenagers episode, the key to marketing was to always take what people were into and find a way to sell it back to them. And when you look at entertainment, you can kind of see how the 70s was like the era of the exploitation film. And that always emphasized like the individual against society. If it was like the tough guy cop film, or the typical, say, blaxploitation film, it was the individual literally railing against society. If it was a horror film, it was the individual, usually like a slasher kind of mass murderer guy, or there was a lot of like we talked about, there's a lot of like religious horror in that from the day. It was the individual as the destroyer of society. In that way, I think that's why like a lot of slasher flicks, especially the early ones, were kind of cathartic.
I hadn't thought about that.
You rooted for the hero, like for the monster, for the bad guy, essentially, because the heroes were such idiots.
Sometimes, yeah.
And oh, go ahead.
I think though that some of that was, I mean, some of the characters were obviously, they were idiots or jerks because, they wanted you to enjoy watching them die. There's no question on that. And then some of it was also that usually they were very badly written and actually a little bit dull overall. And so that was just, where you got emotion. That's where you got your yucks watching these things.
Now I think too, what you're getting, what you've brought up in that, when you look at a lot of these, say, the exploitation films, they also exemplated the individual, because it was typically the individual who was the director slash writer slash probably star of the film and did half the special effects and wrote the score. But it was
John
also,
Carpenter.
yeah, there we go. And it was that idea that it was the one person who could produce this film, whereas before you had like the big budget extravaganzas from the 60s and stuff.
Well, remember, the 70s were the era of New Hollywood, at least the first part of the 70s were. And that was the era of the auteur, the director as this great creative genius mind producing a work of art. That's because, of course, Hollywood was out of ideas at that point, and they're basically going, here's some money, make a film. That seems to work sometimes. And that lasted, of course, until Star Wars killed it. Mm-hmm. When Hollywood said, well, we finally found the formula we were looking for. Thanks, George. All the rest of you, buzz off. And, and we got the 80s from that point on.
And yeah, and in a way, and that was what it was. And this is why I think, too, when you look at the type of entertainment, like the slasher flicks are a good example. If you look at the earliest ones, in some ways they're mm-hmm. morality plays.
Mm-hmm.
The original, like, say, Friday the 13th definitely was.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre was a little different because there was the idea of happenstance.
Right, okay.
The kids were kind of dumb, but they didn't deserve to die. It was just the wrong place, wrong time.
Well, if I remember right, it was kind of, sort of, almost, maybe based on something that really happened. So there was some attempt at that. I don't know if that's real or not. That's what I've heard.
Yeah, they sort of, the story is it's based on Ed Gein.
Right.
Who was a
famous serial killer.
Yeah, and what he was also known for doing is he'd break into graveyards and, like, dig up the bodies, and he'd make, like, furniture out of them.
Everyone needs a hobby.
Well, there you go. Well, there's a Mystery Science Theater episode where they're doing the Why Study Industrial Arts.
Right.
With this really disturbing kid talking about why he loves industrial arts. Mm-hmm. I love working with wood and steel. And then they dub in human skin when you can get it. Yeah. And it just kind of reminds me of that. But yeah, and it comes from that. There was a lot of the earlier, like, slashers, kind of horror films, like, say, the original Last House on the Left and that, where this idea of happenstance,
mm-hmm.
that you were victimized just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, which is countered by the morality plays that you're talking about, where people are getting what they deserve, or don't, as the case may be.
And in some ways, it's that idea of this, the individual, through the mm-hmm. axe murderer, as this motivating, like, force. It's the individual is stronger than society until mm-hmm. say when you get to the cop films, and that you get the individual who's more powerful than that one,
right?
That the story becomes a clash of wills. It's not like, say, the old Dragnet cop mm-hmm. shows, where, you know, they had the investigators and you had the force and they'd call in backup and that. No, it would be like Charles Bronson shooting the axe murderer after he gives the speech. They're just going to let me out because I'm crazy and I'll do it again. And then he just kills the guy, that kind of thing.
So can you give me an example of the kind of cop show you're talking about?
Well, yeah. I mean, the best examples you can get, if you want to talk, say, television, remember, you start the decade with things like Dragnet,
mm-hmm.
which, when people talk about the square uptight show, Dragnet was it.
We're talking about the 70s here.
Yeah. 60s, okay, going into the 70s. Sure. You had Adam 12 was a popular one.
Mm-hmm. I remember it. Adam 12.
Yeah. They had, there was a bunch. And then you suddenly got shows like, say, Kojak.
Mm-hmm.
Or Beretta.
Mm-hmm.
Was another big one. And that comes out of the result that the movies it took off as, like, the first Dirty Harry was super popular.
Right.
You had all the Bronson films where a gang kills his entire family,
mm-hmm.
which was like every film Bronson was in that wasn't the Dirty Dozen. So,
yeah, they're remaking Death Wish. There's a new version coming out shortly.
They've been remaking it since the original came out. They just call it different things.
Not all of them are exactly Death Wish, but yeah, okay, that's true. Technically Taken and all the others are really just Death Wish again.
Yeah, pretty much. And what you end up with in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
I think, is, like we were saying, the idea is you take what people are into and you sell it back to them. That's marketing. Mm-hmm. The 80s did that because that was when, like, say, the slasher flicks took off, but they got really silly.
Mm-hmm.
You had, like, a billion tough guy cop shows, and everybody knows the 80s tough guy cop show, even if you were born in, like, 1998. Because mm-hmm. they were just so trope-laden and it became so prevalent mm-hmm. because you almost cartoonied things up.
Well, I would argue Miami Vice was a cartoon. I mean, it literally was.
Yeah, but like I say, before that you had Commando.
That's true.
And that's, like I said, that's the action movie that ruined action movies.
Yes, it was.
And again, because what they did is they took that, like, you were taking that, like, Dirty Harry buck in the system thing and just taking it to these crazy extremes. Because again, once that became the thing to do, everybody wanted to do more of it and everybody wanted to push the formula. And you'd get, like, all kinds of weird permutations. Like, I remember Cobra with Stallone. That was trying really hard to be a serious film, but kind of falls a little short of the mark.
Sorry to derail this, but something just occurred to me. Since we're
Okay.
talking about strength, and we started off by saying that generally speaking, in modern English entertainment, we generally don't like weak characters, right? We
Right.
want our characters to be strong and everything. But don't slasher fics completely go against that? I mean, our main characters are all a bunch of weak individuals who are being hunted by a strong individual.
Now, see, my argument would be that no, because the characters aren't the characters. The characters are the targets. We're actually following the hero is the slasher.
Oh, I see.
Maybe not hero, but say protagonist. And then this goes with getting to that idea where I think where we started, and I think we're going to end up creeping back to a few times. Strength in the slasher flick is measured a little differently because the character that always lives is,
The virginal female.
yeah, the one who engages in temperance,
Yes, yeah.
the one that has willpower, the one that doesn't fall in with the group, which I think is it's that idea. And I don't know if this was ever intentional, but in especially the earlier ones, and that it seems to go that way. It's that idea where in the Charles Bronson Dirty Harry style cop films, the villain is always like an immutable force. The system can't handle him, and you need that rebel who's above the system. And I'm wondering if the slasher flick, that's what's happening, but the other way, where the true strength of the individual is in temperance. It's in the person with restraint and willpower.
That's an interesting idea.
'Cause you see that in a lot of like horror movies, that idea that what wins is innocence. And that it's a form of strength that it'll manifest that because the slasher flicks its temperance. I'm thinking of movies like say The Gate or Silver Bullet, I think was the one with wasn't that the one with the rocket?
Yes, I think so. I
Yeah,
haven't seen it for a long time.
that it was this idea of it was that friendship, it was that the bond, that's what provided the strength. And that's again, you see a lot of this, and it's funny to note that that's always something inherent as well. That it's even because Silver Bullet, and again, horror movies are a little different from action, but if I remember correctly, the kid that saves the day, he's in a wheelchair, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, he is.
So again, he's depicted as weak, but it's that his friendship and his hope and his attachment to like his family and that, which is an inherent thing that lets him save the day at the end.
What's the old idea of the weak becoming the strong when they need to, like finding the strength within and, fighting on? I mean, you could argue that maybe that's why horror movies, as we understand them, or at least this version of horror movies, came out of the United States, because a lot of them are almost biblical in many ways. Going back to the Christian morality plays specifically, that the temperance wins, the weak become the strong because of their faith, etc. And I almost wonder if that's done on purpose in horror movies, partly to give them some meaning, to keep them from just being about a guy going around killing people. By doing this, it kind of gives the story a kind of extra level that makes the movie a little bit more meaningful, or a little more, give it a little more depth, basically. Or some redeeming quality would be the better phrase, I guess.
I could maybe I could maybe see that. And then what's interesting from that is how many horror movies, especially the ones that don't do really well but become kind of cult classics, sort of circumvent or pervert that idea. that you'll see things where what's normally considered like a virtue. I'm thinking like familial connections.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of family, the idea of family attachment, the idea of like generations of connection.
Right.
How many horror movies that are generally considered B movies but have long lasting appeal
mm-hmm.
come out from that idea?
Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, I'm thinking offhand of, yeah, like a lot of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
That Leatherface's family, that was one of the shticks, was that everybody in town was part of this weird inbred extended family.
Right.
The Hills Have Eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Spider Baby.
Right.
The People Under the Stairs.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you take, like, was it Nightbreed?
Yeah, Nightbreed, definitely.
That you see a lot of, and these are all movies that if you're a horror fan, you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. But if you're like a normal person, you're like, maybe, I don't know. I remember I might have seen an ad for that.
Right, yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's going with the idea, like you were saying, that for a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
perverting that kind of deep-rooted family value kind of thing is a little too much for them. But mm-hmm. for a horror fan who's I guess would be accepting of the horrific, mm-hmm. hence being a horror fan, yeah. it has that extra kind of like point and giggle, snide 14-year-old appeal.
Yes. I can see that. That makes sense. The idea that, you know, the whole family is like messed up instead of just the individual.
Mm-hmm.
But even individual psycho killers have families after all, and maybe they're just like him.
In a way.
Of course, that's going back to the whole Addams Family thing and the Munsters in a way.
Yep.
The subversion of the American family, which, if you think about it, makes a certain amount of sense, especially if you're looking at the 70s and 80s, because we are talking about the era where the 50s and 60s sitcoms were basically run nonstop during our childhood.
Yeah.
So we were constantly being inundated with that old 50s, 60s idea of the nuclear family.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the reasons why our generation is kind of obsessed in some ways with like family dramas and family stories, but subverted ones or twisted ones.
Well, kind of makes sense.
For example, I mean, take a look. The Simpsons,
yeah.
Family Guy, American Dad. Was it the one with Hank Hill?
King of the Hill.
King of the Hill. There we go. King of the Hill. I mean, those are all produced by people of our generation. And if you look at them, you can say these are really just like kind of twisted versions of like 50s and 60s sitcom families in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I think that we grew up with a strong focus on that family, but that family never really represented ours, or maybe it only represented a dream version of ours. And depending on the family, of course, some of us really did have Cleaver families.
Mm.
Cleaver as in the Cleaver family from Leave It to Beaver, not as in the Cleaver family from Leatherface. But anyway, that's not the point.
Of course, the funny thing to that is I think each of us represents one of those two ideals in a way.
That's true. Actually, that's true. We're not going to say who. Anyway, so I think that, you know, what we consume in our childhood, I mean, maybe you could even say that the whole focus on the, you know, the mirror image of the family, you know, by these sitcoms and such that we're talking about is at least partly the result of the fact that most people's families didn't look like that. And they felt almost like because their family wasn't that kind, there must be something wrong with their family.
Right.
And therefore, I don't know, maybe they rejected this image, or maybe they sought to twist it around, or I'm not sure really. Huh. I'm just spitballing here really. I have no point.
I think you're onto something, because I think there's a couple of extra components to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, we grew up on like Leave It to Beaver and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But remember,
God help us.
Yeah. And a terrifying look into the heart of whiteness. But remember, entertainment is always about novelty. So you're always looking to kind of subvert the status quo in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where we get a lot of the back and forth
mm-hmm.
was, I think when you get into the late 70s, early 80s, that idea of family from the 50s, from like the 60s, became the fantasy. And that's where you got like all those horrible like Cosby Show ripoffs.
Mm.
Because The Cosby Show was huge, and I think it was huge because, again, this was a tumultuous time.
Yes.
It harkened back to the quote-unquote good old days,
mm-hmm.
and then that took off. And then eventually, on one hand, you get really tired of it in a hurry, and after we had, like, there were so many Cosby Show ripoffs.
Yes, there were.
Where nothing happened, ever. That mm-hmm. people got tired of that. They wanted something different. And I think part of it, remember, like we said, late 70s going into the 80s, you had the moral majority. You had this clamoring mm-hmm. for traditional values
mm-hmm.
because society was under attack. And I think when you started getting to the mid 80s, late 80s, especially like when you started finding out that the televangelists were all like getting caught doing coke with like male prostitutes and their $200,000 dog houses they got for their $5,000 poodles.
Mm-hmm.
People were tired of the wholesomeness because it felt sanctimonious.
Mm-hmm.
They were tired of another show about nothing. And that was where you started getting the subversion of it, because you did get The Simpsons, you got Married with Children, you got Roseanne.
You'll notice almost all of that, not all, because Roseanne was on ABC, but you almost all of that came from the fledgling Fox network.
Yeah.
That were trying to target the youth demographic at that point. Ironic now that Fox is the station of boomers and old people, but never mind that.
Mm.
Well, at least, correction, the Fox News is, anyway, whatever. The point is that when Fox, the network, first appeared, they were targeting the young people and the youth of the day. And so they did so by providing stuff that was the anti-version or the mirror version of the standard network programming.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we got The Simpsons and Married with Children. And there were, I'm sure, a whole bunch of other like twisted Fox shows from back in the day. Parker Lewis Can't Lose, which yeah. is their version of like the Ferris Bueller movie.
Yeah,
and a whole bunch of others that were providing an alternate, you know, kind of playful, twisted version of the traditional American tropes.
Yeah. And, well, there were a lot of that, too, because, again, once something works, everybody does it.
Well, everyone else did it after Fox suddenly was stealing all their youth demographic. They're suddenly, yeah. holy crap, make stuff that's twisted and subversive as far as we can go. So that's why I think where we got Roseanne. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Roseanne predates that, but I suspect it's from around that period.
Yeah, I think the first one was Married with Children.
I think so, too, yeah. Because that truly was a mere twisted version of the, you know, the Cleaver family, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
It truly was. And from that point on, everything became like twisted around, and, you know, the traditional sitcom family became old hat, and suddenly it was all about weird families of one kind or another, flawed families of one kind or another, yeah. that, were now more relatable in some ways because of their flaws.
In theory. Yeah.
In theory. Exactly. In theory.
And I think that kind of ties into the overarching thing we're discussing.
Well, hold on. I'm going to use that to challenge you again. Okay, uh-oh. So in the case of Married with Children then, okay, how are they strong?
Well, because I think what you're getting,
mm-hmm.
especially when you get into the 80s, that right. the image of strength was, again, the individual.
Right.
And you saw that, like, action movies were like that, that the hero was just immune to the universe in every mm-hmm. single
yep.
film.
And consequences, yep.
Mm-hmm. And
just like the new Spider-Man movie.
Well, just like a lot of movies.
No, trust me, just like the new Spider-Man movie. That's becoming something of a running joke about Spider-Man Homecoming. Sorry, uh-oh. Fans of Spider-Man Homecoming, but Peter faces zero consequence for everything he does in the movie. Zero. Like, have you seen it yet, Don?
No.
Okay. It's not a bad film overall, but I'm just telling you now, he faces zero. Like, it's in some ways, it's the anti-Spider-Man movie. And this ties in with the strong thing we're talking about here. Sorry to completely derail this topic for a second. But it's an example of a character who faces zero consequences, but it's supposed to be a character who faces consequences for everything. Like, that Spider-Man shtick is that everything that can go wrong goes wrong, except that everything that can go wrong goes eh. in the new movie. And that's kind of one of its greatest flaws, I would argue. But again, it's targeted towards a generation that maybe wouldn't accept failure or wouldn't deal with it well. And maybe that's why it did so well.
Yeah, there's kind of a catch to that we're kind of creeping up on.
Right. Okay. Sorry. I derailed things. Let's continue. Let's get back on track while Spider-Man fans, you know, calm down. Okay.
All four of you. Ha ha ha.
No, there's that guy over there.
Okay. Four and a half. That guy's kind of short. Anyway.
Well, that's true. Okay. Sorry, dude. All right. So.
Anyway, but the individual was where strength came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you started seeing when you got to the end of that era was that idea of the all-powerful individual was sort of something people would want to subvert too, because we'd seen every permutation of, like, every action movie, and there were so many action movies in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all followed, like, the exact same formula.
Well, because that formula made money.
Yep, it made a lot.
Yes,
and
it did.
And it was easy. So that's why you had so many, like, say, low-budget action films, most of which you can get on Riff Tracks nowadays, and I highly recommend. But it was that idea that people were starting to want to subvert the idea of the individual. And when you look at all those, like Married with Children, Roseanne shows, you didn't have a family so much as you had a house full of individuals. And it was that clash of individuals that I think it was drawing from like the earlier 80s ideal. It was kind of twisting it. It was kind of taking it back. Because remember, novelty is just the next swing of the pendulum, because there's only so many permutations.
Right, right.
That it was taking it back to that idea that no matter how much these families hated each other, in the end, they would pull together.
Right, yeah.
Often against, like, an outside foe, not out of any... Like, that was the Married with Children thing. They didn't really care about each other. They just hated everybody else more.
Yeah, that's literally true. That's literally true.
But it's that weird idea of subverting that idea of the powerful individual into the collective again, but doing it with a socially pertinent methodology, because that 70s peace and love bullshit still was not sitting well with people. They had enough of that back in the 70s.
Okay. So now we were all individuals and we'd work together when we needed to. Well, that sounds pretty much like 90s society.
Yeah, kind of. Because again, what you get when you get to the 90s, the idea of strength in, like, the macho tough guy thing becomes kind of laughable. You go back to a weird militant version of, like, the 70s inclusiveness. Like, that was the beginnings of political correctness as political correctness.
Yes, it was.
People are feeling down. Like, that idea of the individual who can do everything and is just awesome, it becomes laughable because a lot of people just don't feel that way.
Well, remember, 90s was the era of grunge. It was a reactionary era to the 80s, basically. The era 80s was the era of excess and excess positivity in some ways, too. And the 90s was, wait, this didn't work out so well. Or this didn't apply to many people. And so we got the reaction to it. And we got, of course, the whole alternative music scene. And we got alternative culture and lots of whiny music. And yeah, I mean, it was all about how, well, Generation X, basically, which, of course, you and I are part of, basically woke up and realized that the parents' boomers' dreams weren't going to be their dreams, basically. Right. And they suddenly discovered... Yeah, they weren't all going to be rock stars. Oh, where does that speech come from?
Fight Club.
Fight Club. Oh, yes, there it is. Yeah, do you know the speech offhand?
Yeah, that was, and we woke up realizing we're not all going to be movie, what was it, rock, movie stars and rock gods. And yeah, we're pissed.
Yep, that's it. That's the speech. And I think that's very asymptomatic. I think, you know, Chuck Palahniuk is of our age, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think that he wrote that with that idea. And it's 100% true. And that symbolizes the 90s, I think, in many ways. It might even be worse for the millennials, actually. It probably is, but that's another show.
oh, we're getting point, to that.
We'll get to that. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so the 90s was a reaction to the 80s and that realization that maybe shit wasn't going to quite work out the way we wanted it to. And we weren't all going to be the Cleavers. Heck, we weren't even going to have Mr. Cleaver's apparent job that, you know, gave him incredible affluence and comfort. Or any sitcom family's dad's job who gave them apparently affluence and comfort.
And plenty of time for vacations.
Yep. And plenty of time to spend with the family.
Mm-hmm. Because that's when you get to the 80s, and not the 80s, you get from the 80s to the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to look at the dominant attitudes that you still had that individualism.
Mm-hmm.
That again, it was the 70s again, and that individualism was really taking that turn to selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of the individuals, the all-powerful being that gets the job done, was different, and what became strength in the 90s was weakness.
Mm-hmm.
That it wasn't about getting everything done. It was that realization that nothing mattered. It was like almost like grunge was almost nihilism.
It was in a lot of ways, yeah.
And it's you see that when you look at, say, the heroes of the day, there was kind of entire collapse of, like, say, the action movie genre.
Mm-hmm.
But they went to, like, weird places.
Yeah, 90s action movies are kind of odd. The action movies kind of disappeared for a little while, almost. Because they weren't quite sure what to do with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. I mean, there are 90s action movies. I mean, take a look, for example, at the Bay and Bruckheimer films, like The Rock, Con Air.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we would get Armageddon at the late 90s. I mean, there are action films in the 90s, lots of them, but they're different. And I think it's because the 80s action film formula had stopped working.
Yeah.
And so they weren't quite sure what to do. And so they were kind of shotgunning it and trying all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah, they usually, there was a lot of like the movies would, the 90s ones, the heroes would have some kind of like, they brought back the idea of like a weird tragic past.
Mm-hmm.
That actually affected them.
Yep.
You got a lot of like moodiness, almost like a film noir kind of sensibility came back.
Yep.
Because everybody was like an alcoholic again and stuff.
Yep. They pretty much were all disillusioned in one form or another.
Yeah. And then that went with that attitude, because to win in the 90s was to lose.
Yeah. Because there is no victory.
Yeah, and that was, oh my God.
It's all meaningless.
Yeah, I fucking hated grunge because it was just basically every band trying to whine about why their life sucked harder, and you just wanted to slap all of them. But yep. Anyway, just saying.
Neither of us were fans of grunge/alternative music back in the 90s, folks. You're not going to find that here. That's why both Don and I were majorly into metal during the 90s.
Yeah.
Because it was the only positive music around. Like, it was literally the only music of that period. Well, not the only, but pretty much the only music of that period that was about doing stuff and striving and accomplishing and not giving up.
Yeah.
Whereas the general, like, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, you know, Smells Like Teen bullshit, were basically, was all about... what? It was all about whining and crying and my life sucks. It's like, really, dude, just buck up, okay? Just get it together. Look, either check out or get with the program.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it turned into solipsism really fast.
Yep.
And then that was the thing that you saw with, I think that's where, especially for your science fiction and that, when you get near the end of the 90s, the characterization style for everything was angry, like, and that was everything. And it's because you sort of come full circle again, that it was all these like hard pressed individuals under one roof, but it wasn't like Roseanne where they'd pull together, because we didn't have that faith in institutions or groups or that.
Mm-hmm.
It was that they would fall apart when pulled together. And that's where you got that friction. And that's why like every single everything was just like a major debate.
Mm-hmm.
Like you saw that science fiction was terrible for that. Like the underlings would argue with the commander. Cop shows were bad because you always had internal investigations show up when something would happen, and it was always like traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
Like the hero would, you know, shoot a guy in the line of duty, and IA would come in and, well, he's confined to desk. How do you take him off the street? He's a good guy. And it would just be an argument when in real life,
mm-hmm.
that's what you would do. It's not a big deal. It's standard procedure. You just killed a guy. That's something. They want to let you cool down. They're going back to the Squaresville 70s. There was an episode of Adam 12 that was about that.
Oh, was there? I don't remember that one.
That the young guy, it was a dude took hostages on a school bus, and the young guy shot him, and then the next episode was him hanging around the office because he had to like hand in his weapon and they wanted to evaluate him, and it was just portrayed as routine. It wasn't a conflict.
Right. Well, remember, everything had to be conflict. Conflict had to be turned up to 11 on everything.
And I think again too was because you had that idea of the individual. It was being pushed just as hard as the 80s, but it wasn't the strength of the individual, it was the individual being hard pressed by society. And that was why any kind of routine consequence like that had to turn into an argument. It had to be a big deal because it was the man stepping on like the little guy, man. And again, in the 90s, that was a big deal because, like I say, we'd lost our faith in institutions and establishments. So they had to be the villain, even when they weren't the villain.
They weren't trustworthy anymore. Okay, I can
Yeah.
see that.
And it was the idea too that the big institutions would work in their own interest to keep you down, which is kind of a recurring idea, but what we lost over the 80s was the idea that the individual could rail against that.
Right. Okay. So it's all about the strength of the individual then at this point. All right.
Yeah, well, like I say, I think what ended up happening was that was for North America, that was always there. But when you started getting into like the 50s and that, when marketing was taking off, when you were finding ways to use that to sell shit. Like in a way, that was what teenagers were invented for. It was actualizing the young individual and then making them, as best you could, a consumer. Which you had brought up before, that idea, when did we stop being citizens and when did we start becoming consumers?
And the answer is still, I don't know. Some point, maybe it was the 50s or 60s, probably earlier than that. But anyway, but that's another topic for another show. All right, so we get to the 90s. Everything's about conflict, and I would argue that hasn't really changed. I mean, actually, we yes and no. Maybe we've gone full circle because I know during the 2000s things did change. I mean, conflict still was kind of up to 11, but I noticed that we started in the 2000s getting a lot more stories that were more group oriented. Like the 2000s were an era of more group-oriented heroes and entertainment, literally heroes, because there was the show Heroes that was about that. And it was about individuals being part of groups again. And I think it goes back and forth. Maybe it's like everything. We're constantly facilitating between people as part of a group and people as individuals. And there's that constant tug of war going on in society. And I think the 2000s were primarily about groups and group dynamics and families. Even, for example, the remake of Battlestar Galactica, for example, is ultimately just about a feuding family with cousins that are robots that want to kill them. Not anyway.
Oh, we've all been
And
there.
well, that's true. That's very true. Hi, cuz. Anyway, so there's that. I mean, and I'd say most shows in the 2000s were all about families and family dynamics. And I think that's the result of that constant swing back and forth. And you can kind of see it where I'd actually say we've done a full round of swinging again. We've actually gone through another cycle since then. That would be the early 2000s. By the late 2000s, I think we went back to the individuals again, individualism again. And now I would actually say right now we're actually starting to arc back towards the group dynamic thing again.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of weird steps in between.
Okay, I've probably jumped a few. I know I skipped 9/11. I skipped a financial crisis. I skipped a few things that I think were key turning points in some of this. Because, for example, I think 9/11 caused America and people to kind of band together. And I think that that's where a lot of that family-oriented dynamic or group-oriented dynamic came from during the 2000s. I think that 9/11 made everyone suddenly kind of like, oh, well, we're all just one big family. And so that was reflected by that. And suddenly people wanted to trust institutions again because, you know, we can't all stand alone against this great terrorist threat, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but by the late 2000s, we get the financial crisis, though, and that basically rips apart everyone's faith in institutions.
Yeah.
The government was supposed to be on the job, and look what happened. Everyone's 401ks are gone in the States. Your retirement plans are destroyed. Corporations are now shutting down or, you know, taking all the money and not passing it to the little guy. Mm-hmm. The banks got bailed out, but everyone else didn't. Screw the government. Screw everyone. Screw you all. And we're back to the individual again.
Yeah, I could. It's interesting looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
That I do think, yeah, because it's the swing of the pendulum. When you get to like the late 90s going into the 2000s, it's interesting to see that there's a supporting of the individual again.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, that was the era of famous for being famous.
Right.
Which was the 80s.
That's true.
The 80s thing, the conspicuous consumption, the individual is the source of everything.
Well, keep in mind, what did the President of the United States tell people to do after 9/11?
Shop.
Go out and shop. Yeah. Exactly. That was the focus. It was all about, as you said, the conspicuous consumption. It was all about keeping the economy going.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also the era of things like Undercover Boss, for example, and such. Yeah. I mean, this is the era where it was all about bringing the corporation and the consumer together, and we're all in this together, and we're all Americans, and we all care about, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We all care about keeping the economy going and living the good life. Everyone's living on credit at this point, and that's just the way it will be. That's why the financial crisis will happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it did mean that there was huge amounts of money sloshing around in the system for a little while.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other factors as well, of course. The internet, the rise of the internet and internet commerce and all that's going on as well.
Right.
And that's affecting things. But ultimately, we still, before the financial crisis, we still, as you say, we have that 80s ideal conspicuous consumption going on.
Yeah.
And it's good times, and the good times roll until, again, financial crash, and suddenly the good times are not rolling, and everyone's in it for themselves again.
Yeah, which happened in the original 80s, because
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, too, if this ties in with the idea that we live the same two decades over and over.
I think that there's a cycle there that what you call the two decades represents, mm-hmm. but I don't think we're living the exact same two decades over and over. I mean, based on my thoughts tonight anyway, I would argue that there are pendulums, there are cycles that are happening,
mm-hmm.
but what you call the same two decades is just a reflection of that.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's the group and the individual, things are going back and forth. And again, they don't always last for a decade. Sometimes they're shorter cycles, or maybe they're just getting shorter.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, let me think. But I mean, there are also other social forces in effect.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it. There's the economies rise and fall. Societies shift back and forth.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of things that are happening at the same time. It's a complicated mess. I mean, we like to try to simplify it down. Everyone does, especially economists and historians and whatever. But it's a frickin' mess. And it's a very complicated thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge amount of unpredictability. Or at least what on the surface looks like unpredictability.
Yeah.
Because we never quite know when one period is going to start and when one period is going to stop.
Yeah, because that's usually ascribed in hindsight.
Exactly. I mean, so for example, no one except maybe the CIA and certain members of the U.S. government knew about 9/11 or knew what was going to happen.
Depending on who you ask.
Depending on who you ask, exactly. So. And so, who knows, maybe that's our generation's, you know, Kennedy shooting, I'm not sure. And so anyway, the point is that was an unexpected event.
Right.
Now one could argue that something like that was going to happen sooner or later. It just happened to happen at that time.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things that really, you know, shook America out of its happy period, Well, except it wasn't really a happy period at all. I mean, the people were not happy at that point, really. If anything, it was a shock that brought everyone together, as I just said, more than it was something that divided people. Again, there's that ex we don't like each other, but we have an exterior foe, and suddenly we're working together against it. So, I don't know. I think that that's representative of that. And then again, the financial crisis, another shock that suddenly forces everyone against each other. Now, the one that I find more puzzling, if we're going to keep on this topic for a little bit, is why we're getting back into the era of the group now again. Because you would think that the rise of the whole Trumpism and everything would actually encourage more individualism, if anything else. But it's doing the opposite. The rise of Trump and everything is actually causing everything to go back to the group mind again. Now, maybe that's just cyclical and there are other factors involved, which obviously there must be. But right now, I would say we're in another group period. I think we've been going into it for a little bit, and now we're coming, we haven't come to the head of it, but we're definitely coming into one. And I'd argue that the whole political correctness phase that we went through, if I would argue, actually peaked about a year or two ago. We're kind of on the downswing of it, of the whole social justice movement. I mean, 2 years ago, think about this, or 3 years ago, people would be, promoting social justice online, and you would see almost no dissenting voices whatsoever. Now the internet is filled with people calling the whole social justice movement, BS or whatever, and the individual, and there's that idea that, how can I put this? The individual is not as important as they once were, and that we should believe in groups, I think, is there now. I don't know. I'm just, this is my feeling on the subject anyway. I think that we're not to the peak of the group mind yet, but we probably will reach it in another maybe year or two. And then we'll go back to the individual. Now, actually, you can see it in some ways now that I think about it, because remember, all our society now is this. It's us versus them. It's group versus group. It's the Nazis versus Antifa. It's the Black Lives Matter group versus the police. It's group versus group. It's all about the groups in our society now, not the individuals. It's all about the groups. Whereas I would argue 3 or 4 years ago, it was all about the individual. It wasn't about the groups. It was all about individuals making a difference or trying to, so to speak. And I think there's been a huge shift.
I think you're right, but I think it's not exactly like a shift. Because what we've got now, it seems like the individual is still being like celebrated,
Oh, yeah, of course. That's the internet.
but it's the individual as group. That and it might be a weird like internet social media thing, but it's the idea that it's like everybody for themselves. Like you see a lot of that,
Definitely.
but people get this idea in their head that the group they belong to is part of them. It's not that they're part of the group.
Okay, can you explain that more clearly?
No. Okay, let me see if I can work my way through this. You refer to something like, say, Trumpism. And there's a lot of people that, are on his side, and he's like our fearless leader.
Apparently, like 30% of America, give or take.
But what it seems to manifest is he's not our fearless leader because we believe in him. He's our fearless leader because he's doing everything that we want. That we're not rooting for him. We're seeing him as he's the political arm of our wants and desires that will get things done how we want them done.
He's an extension of us.
And then to go the other way, if you look at, like, say, the social justice thing, it's not that I'm part of this cause that I believe in. It's that this cause exemplates me, my values, my personality, my identity, how I think the world should work.
Okay, I see your point. Okay, I can see that.
And this is one of the reasons why if you're on one side or the other and you're arguing against the other, it's difficult to pin your argument down because what looks like a unified movement totally isn't.
it's all ultimately people that are just viewing everyone else as pawns in their game.
No, it's not even that. It's this idea that you look at, say, like a lot of argument put against like the social justice warrior idea is how vague it is. Like, what exactly do these people want? It's vague because it's not actually a movement. It's just a whole shitload of individuals that seem to think that these other bunch of individuals agree with me and I'm awesome. So that's why I'm blessing them with my presence. And it's the same thing if you look at, like, say, like you refer to Trumpism. What does the man stand for? It can be damn near anything because everybody's reading into it what they want.
Right.
And it's, again, because the movements you're part of, you're not part of the movement. The movement is part of you.
Right.
And the movements nowadays all seem super vague because they're not really a movement. They're just kind of a bunch of individuals that bump into other guys that seem to kind of be on their side. They read into it, yeah, you're with me, right? And then it goes from there. And that's why you see so much fluidity amongst different groups.
Okay. And that's why they're so willing to turn on each other at the drop of a hat, because as soon as the others start getting away from what each of them wants the others to be, they will turn on them.
Yeah.
Because they're breaking the flow, man. They're disrupting things, or they're keeping the group from doing what that person wants them to do.
Yeah, and then that's why what ends up, you don't get an argument against them. They're declared evil and taboo, and then like you either post angry YouTube videos about it, or you get up at 3 a.m. and tweet about it. And this is why, it looks like different groups will turn on each other a drop of a hat, because they're not really a group.
Right. They're all still individuals working. Now, but how has that changed? Like, I have to wonder, though, hasn't it always been that way? I mean, even unions, for example, like workers' unions, are all ultimately still individuals that are all in it for the collective good, but they're all using each other for their own purposes. And that's from, like, what, 100 years ago? That's not new.
Yeah, but when you talk about something like, say, a union or like an actual political movement or that, they usually have readily defined goals.
Right.
And that's what I think the big difference from then to now is. That if we form a union, it's because we're working for the collective of the workers, and there's specific targets we have. That would be increased pay. That would be better conditions. That would be more time off. That would be job security.
But there are things that benefit all of them as individuals.
Yeah, but there's a goal. It's the same thing like if we form a political party. And historically, you'd put out a platform. We believe in A, B, and C, not D and E, maybe F. Yeah. What you get nowadays is for political groups, that becomes more fluid because they're not looking at it. The people who are part of it don't see it as part of a movement. They see the movement as part of them.
Okay.
And this is why you get like, you'll get weird, baffling statements that come out of different groups. The thing that I've put forth with a bunch of people, if you're having like, say, a political argument with somebody, ask them, okay, well, let's say your side wins. What does that look like? Like, what's the world? It's better. Okay, better how? Because there's no mission statement. There's no cohesive goal. It's just a group of individuals that this makes them feel good. So that's why they're part of this group.
But they don't actually have an end game because they haven't thought it through. They don't actually know what their real goal is.
Well, their goal is ultimately self-gratification.
But how does that make them any different than the hippies during the 60s and 70s, you know, the baby boomer version, who were ultimately also in it for self-gratification and had no clear goal when they were tearing down their society around them?
And you'll notice a lot of the hippies died out, but there were underlying goals that pushed the movement. A big one was, I don't want to go to war and die.
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't want to go to NAMM. Yeah. That was a really big one.
And if you look at like the hippie movement, yeah, it was all this vague peace and love, man. Okay, what does that mean?
Not war, me not dying, I think is what it meant.
Yeah, and when you look at...
And drugs.
Yeah. And sex. And when you look at the hippie movement, the biggest thing that they achieved was that they the anti-war thing.
Yeah.
Because that was a goal. And then what happened towards the end of the hippie movement, and in some ways out of that, you had stuff like the Equal Rights Movement. You had stuff like the for different like minority groups and that started making headway in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But that, again, was because you would have specific goals.
Right.
And I think one of the things that we get now, and it's what we've referred to as culture war profiteering, is that there's a lot of different groups, people, and organizations that are willing to take your vague notions and direct them for you, mostly for their own benefit, to sell you stuff.
Right.
And we've seen that before. It's just we're kind of in a high period. And I think, again, because everybody's got like the activist mentality, but they don't have a lot of focus or direction.
Right.
And that's why it's easy. Like, you know, if you already feel put upon by the government, and who doesn't, you know, conservative, liberal, or whatever, who doesn't at some point, it's real easy for me to sweep in there and say, because they're evil, they're bad, you'd better buy my muscle supplement and my special brand of bug-out bags for when society collapses.
1995. Order now.
Yeah, oh no, they're more than 1995.
I know they are.
Yeah, and that's what you see, and you start seeing that. And then you'll see things like, you'll get movements. Again, this comes more from like the social justice warrior thing, where people aren't selling you something directly, but because it makes them feel good to have people agree with them, you'll get protests against weird things, and you'll get the idea. And this is actually where my notion of, okay, so if you win, what does that look like? You'll get people who will protest like movies and books and comics and that. And you say, okay, so what should we be doing? Well, don't do that. Okay. But what should we be? Show me what we should be doing. You're saying that this is horrible, degrading, vile, like brainwashing material that I'm producing. Well, show me something that's good. Show me something that's wholesome. Show me something that exemplates these ideals. You don't. And this is where, like, you had written that article about, with a lot of protests, it's about what you shouldn't be doing. It's not what about people should be doing. And it's because it's that idea. It just makes you feel good to inflict yourself on other people. There's no ideology. There's no underlying cause. There's no goal. It's just, I don't like this. And it can't be, I don't like this because it doesn't appeal to me. It's, I don't like this, so it must be some horrifying attack on me personally.
Right. Well, again, as we've talked about, everything is personal now. Everything is about the individual, including that everything must be for the individual. And if it's not good for you, then, or good for me, then it's obviously bad.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as the simple idea of it's just not for you.
Yeah.
Like there can be things in society that just aren't for you. They're just not for you, dude. It doesn't make them bad. It's just not for you.
Yeah. FOMO. But
people don't think that way.
No, and like I say, the problem that we've got is nowadays there's plenty of people that are willing to take that and run with it for their own benefit.
Yeah, there are.
And that's, I think that kind of the beginnings of that go back to the 90s with Nerd Rage.
Go back to the 90s with Nerd Rage? How?
Well, because I think Nerd Rage was kind of the first manifestation of that. And I say it because, like, I worked in a comic shop back in the 90s. And I remember you'd get people who would come in and they'd express discontent with, like, the books they were reading. And it never seemed to be the idea that, well, I find that the last few months' worth of Batman have not been to my liking. Perhaps it is time that I move on to try something different, even for a little while, and I can always come back and check out what's happening with Batman later. It was never that. It was always, oh my God, these books are horrible, and like they don't get it at all, and and they're raping my childhood, and I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit reading, and good luck, man, because you're going to go out of business, and you're going to be poor and sad, and I'm going to laugh because you destroyed Batman. It was always that. It was always
Nerd Rage.
Yeah, it was Nerd Rage was always personal, and this is why like, for me, it was baffling because I realized that, no, Batman changes every couple of years. It's just after 20 years of reading it, you've seen every version that there's ever going to be. There's it move on. Try Grimjack. It's Grimjack is a much better comic, but it was never that. And I think what ends up happening is when you get to like the 2000s and later, yeah, you start seeing organizations that are learning to harness that to their own benefit. And then that's why everybody's nerd raging nowadays.
Right. So how does all of this then tie back to our topic of strength?
It's interesting. I think because what we've got when we were, we've got kind of a weird, sad, unfortunate hybrid of the worst of both aspects of this thing. That you've got the gratification, the exemplarization of the individual, but in a collective of their worst possible traits.
So what you're saying is the reason that characters have to be strong now is because they're all wish fulfillment versions of the audience.
Yeah, in one way or another. And I think.
And if they're not a pure wish fulfillment version of that particular audience member's beliefs or opinions, feelings, whatever, then they're automatically the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting that you point that out because I think again that ties into the first symptoms of this were nerd rage. And superheroes were genuinely always 14-year-old male power fantasies. Like almost always. You go back to the
Oh yeah,
50s, they were.
that's what they've always been. That I don't think that's changed.
No, and then that was why the idea like people nowadays, if you're under the age of 30, don't realize that at one point being a nerd was bad.
We've
And
talked about that.
yeah, and then that was like the appeal of like the X-Men was that they're outcasts, but they're outcasts because they're better than everyone else because they got powers. Like how nobody likes me because I'm smarter than them, but one day I'll drink milk and show them and blah, blah, blah. And and yeah, the milk ad thing is kind of bothering me now too because I remember those back in the 90s. It's because those milk ads are all revenge fantasies.
Milk ads are. Oh wait, you're right. You drink milk, you grow up big, and you kick the other guy's butt.
Yeah, or like you rub it in the face of the person who turned you down for a date or whatever. Yeah, those milk ads were all just, and I'll show you suck.
Wow, milk ads is revenge fantasy. I'd never thought about that, but that's true.
And those are from the 90s, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Yeah. Yep, you're right. I mean, I think though that people have been touting like revenge fantasies. I mean, that goes back to those in the old like 60s comic books where they have those ads for, here's how to become a bodybuilder and like, kick sand in that other guy's face. I
Yeah.
mean, revenge fantasies are not exactly a new way to sell product.
No, they're not. They're not. But it's that idea of like we say all the time, there's never just kind of one thing going on. There's never one perspective. It's a bunch of things kind of all bumping into each other. But it does seem in the last little while that the solipsism has really taken hold in society, and you see that. Like, I would argue again more than in the 80s, that like it's the 80s again, but it's more 80s than the 80s.
Well, yeah. Okay, I can see that. And let's take this back around then to my comment earlier about Spider-Man, about how there's no consequence. Is that because we see characters suffering consequence in stories as weakness? That if you're truly strong, there are no consequences for you? Because we all know that's how it really works for the rich, most
Well,
of the time.
I think what you've got, and this is why I kind of wanted to get back to that. We've got that weird sort of hybridization because I can think of another example besides like the new Spider-Man, but we're at that point where the individual is all because it's the 80s again. But we don't want like the world busting tough guy cop Ferris Bueller super charming gets his way kind of thing because that's seen as like crass and tacky. So we exemplary ourselves through our organizations and such. But we still you want that feeling of I guess you'd say achievement of success of inflicting yourself on the world. And we've gone the other way, rather than like the 80s, say, invincible action hero.
Mm-hmm.
We have the hero who's never really challenged.
Hmm.
Because I'm thinking, what's the most horrifying thing about Twilight? It was that there's no consequence to anything in any of the story. It looks like there is,
mm-hmm.
but there totally isn't. And then that's what this kind of thing is. It's that 80s, the hero acts with impunity, but the other mm-hmm. way around, not because they're so awesome they can just challenge the world, but because the world just isn't challenging.
Okay, so it's basically lowering the bar as a way to let the hero win. So the hero is good, but not absolutely amazing, and we just lower the bar of challenge to let them win. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know if that's exactly the correct phraseology, because I think mm-hmm. when you say it like that, you're sort of making a value judgment on it.
Right.
It's what's happening, but I wouldn't say lowering the bar, because then that leads to... Because like in our day, our heroes were awesome, and these guys are just idiots, and blah, blah, blah. It's something... It's something... Because again, you're essentially right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the idea that we're winning the conflict
mm-hmm.
not by an application of power, but by there just not really being a conflict.
Okay. I think you're gonna have to explain this a little more clearly. I mean, there is usually a conflict. I mean, there's, say, most movies, there's usually a hero and a villain, so to speak, one kind or another, and they are definitely in conflict with each other.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that it's in some ways it's the 80s action movie where the hero doesn't really have to work for it, but it happens different. I didn't see Spider-Man, so God help me, I'm gonna have to go back to Twilight again.
Okay.
My quintessential example of everything horrifying. Like I said, you look at, they're vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the downside of being a vampire? Well, you sparkle in the sunlight. Well, that's not really
apparently
a downside.
That's it. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Old vampires used to burst in the flame in the sun. Well, okay, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They have to drink blood and feed on humans, even ones they care about, except they totally don't, just because.
Mm-hmm.
The hero of the story, if you could call her that, is like an introvert, and she's the new kid, and everybody just loves her just because. So there's no, like, it's the trappings of conflict, it's the trappings mm-hmm. of difficulty, but there's none of the difficulty.
Right.
And
I understand what you're saying. I do understand what you're saying. I mean, I guess that's mostly the result of it just being, you know, a wish fulfillment fantasy. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Twilight is classic Mary Sue fiction. It's
right.
Classic. The main character is supposedly this, you know, views herself as this downtrodden, you know, introverted, you know, not unpopular kid, except everyone totally loves her, including every hot guy who comes along, and she's like cared about by everyone and can't really do anything wrong, and everything goes right in her life ultimately. Like, I mean, it seems to go wrong, but nothing ever really goes wrong in her life.
Right.
And even her vampire boyfriend only sparkles. He doesn't actually burst into flames. He doesn't really need to drink blood, except when it's cool and can turn her into a vampire, at which point she becomes, like, sparkly and can drink blood. And it's all completely awesome. And, yeah, there's no consequence there whatsoever. Even her father is kind of like, oh, you're a vampire. Okay, well, that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like being a goth or something? I'm okay with that, though. That's all right.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay. So, all right. There's literally no consequence. Like I said, even her father, who should be against her boyfriend, isn't.
Yeah.
Why? Because this is the ultimate expression of wish fulfillment fantasy. That's just pure, pure version of it. Does that make it better or worse than, say, Conan the Barbarian? No, it doesn't, actually. Although you could argue maybe that Conan did actually have to deal with a few more challenges than, you know, Bella Swan. But okay, well, whatever. But they're still ultimately, they're Mary Sue characters. And what you seem to be implying is that the Mary Sue character, which is the which is supposed to be the bad character that we're supposed to try to avoid in writing and creating, has kind of become dominant. Like, they're the ones that really seem to resonate with the audience.
I think the Conan thing is a good example.
Okay.
Because in the Conan stories,
mm-hmm.
Conan would win just by being super awesome.
Okay.
So 1,000 guys would attack him, and just because he's such like an awesome swordsman, he'd just kill them all. And mm-hmm. the temple would fall on him, but because he's just like so awesomely powerful, he'd like support the main pillar long enough to like escape. And Conan, dig that guy, he's just cool. A modern version of that would be that Conan doesn't like face, he doesn't have to be an awesome swordsman because he's not being attacked by like 1,000 guys. It's like one dude that he goes, hey, your shoe's untied, and then he walks by him. And he doesn't have to be super awesome, strong, and like lift the temple, because the temple doesn't fall on him. He runs into like a stuck door that he plays with a mitten, and he opens it and walks in. It's that kind of thing.
Hmm.
That both cases, like most characters really are some kind of wish fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
But we've gone the way we're no longer doing, like I said, like the 80s action hero, making it more extreme. Even like, well, we still have action movies that do extreme, because you get like the Fast and Furious where they just do like mm-hmm. super crazier car stunts.
Oh yeah, we're getting super extreme stuff. Yeah.
But you're also sort of edging to the way that there just aren't that many challenges for the heroes, or what should be challenges get parsed down even more. And again, I would say it's sort of just a permutation of the 80s thing, because like, you look at, say, the Fast and the Furious movies, any given movie, count how in real life, how many people would be dead. Like, there's one where they kill the entire police force of the city. There's no way any of those cops survive those accidents.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't come up.
Well, no. I mean, and that goes back to the consequence, though. We don't want anything icky getting in the way of our fun fantasy fulfillment run.
Right.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's not out of any nefarious means. It's just that we don't want to ruin the mood, basically.
Right. But it seems like more and more the mood is getting to be that we don't even have that tension. That things seem to be really pat right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is a bad thing then?
Yeah, because I lived through the 80s once, and I don't want to have to do that again.
Dude,
and again. But
do I have to make it clear? It's not all about you.
It is! You're ruining my childhood!
Okay. But assuming it's not all about you, because it's all about me, obviously, why should I care if this is becoming the new template for like media and such, for like pop culture? That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, man. It's okay.
Kinda.
You still got your old crap that you can look at. You still got that old shit. It's, you know, somewhere around. It's dusty, but whatever. Maybe black and white. And then the kids today, they can just watch whatever they want. I mean, they can watch stuff that they enjoy that may or may not have, like, drama and tension and everything. And I do have to say, though, being serious for a moment, that I suspect this is part of the reason why stuff from Asia especially is generally just kicking ass in terms of North American audience. Uh-huh. And I don't just mean anime, but I mean anime, Korean dramas, Chinese movies. I mean all this stuff, because they don't do any of that crap. They're still doing it kind of the old school way where, yes, especially with the Chinese stuff, a lot of it is wish fulfillment fantasy. But at the same time, they're not watering it down. Like, the characters are still dealing with real challenges.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that the audience actually does want. Like, mm-hmm. I think they really do want it, but I think they're not getting it from a lot of North American entertainment. I mean, a lot of North American entertainment has become so formulaic and so simple that it's literally the character just walking through the adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the plot might as well be a ride at Disney for practical purposes. And I'm referring to pretty much anything with a special effects budget of over $100 million is basically just a Disney ride at this point, where we're just riding along while these characters go through their ride.
Mm-hmm.
So we vicariously go for a ride, and stuff is flying at us, and there's stuff going crazy all over the place and shit. And in the end, there's no danger. There's no real sense that the characters are really going to fail.
Right.
It's everyone knows the rules. Everyone knows that at the end of the story, everything's just going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we all just kind of go along with it. And there's no attempt to build a story that's filled with tension.
Right.
But I'd say a lot of the Asian stuff still has, at least not all of it, but a fair amount of it, still has some of that tension to it. They're actually still trying to do that.
Yeah.
There are probably a couple of reasons for it. But generally speaking, it's because they have their own ideas of what's entertainment and their templates. I mean, and they're also drawing from us, though. I imagine more of the Chinese stuff especially will end up being more like the American stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, my point is that, so I can see that there is a demand for it, but I can see where the North American stuff is going for the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, some of it is, because if you look at some of the things that are popular,
mm-hmm.
they really do kind of buck that trend, because you look at Game of Thrones.
Right.
Walking Dead used to be popular for the same idea, that you didn't know if they were going to make it, but I guess people, it's not as popular now because folks are getting tired of watching guys walk through the woods.
Well, and argue with each other.
Yeah.
And while zombies wander through the background, which is pretty much what Game of... That's pretty much it, yeah. Are people arguing and zombies. Mm. That's the real title of The Walking Dead. But I think I've said that joke more than a few times, but it's true. It's very true. You're right. I mean, and there are exceptions, but even if we look at, say, the new Star Trek series, Star Trek Discovery, I've noticed something about that show. Now, as it's gone on, I'm not going to get into spoilers. Don't worry, people. But as it's gone on, I've found myself enjoying it more. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk after the show's over more detail about this between the two of us, because you've probably been watching it too.
Yeah.
But as it's gone on, I've noticed that the main character really doesn't actually have to deal with that many real challenges.
Yeah.
Like, it's still really, really light in the challenge department for the main character, for Michael Burnham there mm-hmm. in the new Star Trek Discovery. In fact, I would argue there has been greater challenge on the Orville
mm-hmm.
than there has on Discovery. Characters have actually been in more jeopardy and had to deal with more difficult situations on the Orville, which is a quasi-sci-fi comedy, than they have on Discovery, which is supposed to be a hardcore sci-fi action over-the-top series.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for a lot of things. Now, is it true for everything? No, obviously not. I mean, there are, quote-unquote, more mature dramas where I suspect that they are actually, you know, giving the character some really hard issues to deal with. Although, then again, everything now is about kidnapped kids, apparently. And I'm not sure why. I think it's because there was the disappearance or something, whatever. Mm-hmm. There was some, I think, British one or something that, like, set the tone. I think it was Broadchurch.
Broadchurch.
That the one Tenet was in a couple years back.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone went nuts for it. It's basically like a kid disappears. And so the investigators go in to find out about the kid, and of course uncover like tons of stuff about, like, you know, all the other people in town and etc. What's going on in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to remember, the Americans did that years ago too, but I'm trying to remember what it was called.
Taken.
Twin Peaks.
Oh, okay.
Twin Peaks is one of the first times I remember seeing that, because the whole point was that the agent went in because the Laura something was missing.
Right.
And he discovered this town is filled with weird people. But at this point, it eventually turned into the current version, which is a kid goes missing.
Oh, okay.
And there's been like a crap ton of versions of it. Like, this is half the dramas, it seems, on Netflix or whatever. It's like a kid goes missing and everyone loses their minds, basically.
Huh.
I mean, that's the current drama template. And they're all serials. I mean, they're all basically these giant serial stories that drag on for however long they need to before they discover the kid is either A, dead, or not really dead and was kidnapped by probably the second person the detective talked to.
Right.
Spoilers. Anyway, so I don't watch any of these shows, folks, so it's not really a spoiler. I have no idea. But based on my knowledge of the mystery formula and everything, it'll be the second person the detective talked to. Trust me.
Hmm.
All right. So anyway, my wife hates it when I do that. I watch the first couple minutes of a mystery show and go, him, and then I leave.
Yeah, my grandmother used to do that all the time, too.
Yeah, and it's like, yep, I because once you know the formula and once you know who to look for, it's really obvious
Yeah.
because they're always using the same formula. And anyway, neither here nor there. The point is that so there is some, like, I guess stuff with tension, I guess, being done. I'm guessing. I'm hoping. It's not all that way, but as far as our quote unquote popular entertainment, like the big media spectacles, and that they're all pretty much complete crap. They're all pretty much this low intensity crap.
That's a, tell us how you really feel.
I mean, well, I mean, one can only watch so many Marvel movies before it really. Yeah, okay, this again. Okay, that's why my theory is still that once the current phase, I guess phase three, is done,
Right.
I think the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe has got maybe one more phase to it, and then it's done. Then, by which I mean, then they will reboot it, of course. I don't mean it's actually done. That's the point where they'll say, ticket sales are down, let's just restart everything and hire someone else to be Tony Stark.
Wow.
Because the old guys are gone, basically, with the current cycle ended, and I don't think any of the new lead characters are going to have enough star power or interest from the audience to hold up. Plus,
Right.
there's the problem they can't do origin movies anymore because the audience is freaking sick of them.
Well, you can if you do new characters.
Well, you could if you did new characters, but that's not going to happen either.
If you think about it, if they'd only start making Skull the Slayer movies, you've got like five origin movies right there just in the established continuity.
Well, there we go.
So that's the
There we
secret.
go.
Skull the Slayer will save the Marvel Universe.
Ooh, sounds good. All right. So before we go, you actually took exception with something I said at the very beginning. I referred to things I believe as male power fantasies. Like I talked about the male idea of strength, and I think you were going to take exception with me for about that. So what's the deal?
Well, I wouldn't say take exception, because for a lot of the stuff we talk about, you're right. But I think the idea of what constitutes a strong character, it changes over time, and the female ideal is a little different.
Which was my point.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to get at, because I wanted to say, to give the idea that historically, and this is why I think it's so difficult for a North America film to have like a female action lead, that there's been this idea, and it goes with what we talked about the horror films, and that a strong female lead is one that maintains temperance. It's based on like willpower, on wholesomeness, that kind of thing. And it's funny to see because there are so many like female oriented stories. I used to ruin them, the books for people at work, because it'd be stories about like this woman who gets on with her life and her ex-boyfriend's trying to kill her and she meets this new guy. And I used to say, no, in the second last chapter, the new guy's gonna like accidentally push the old guy off a cliff and he's gonna die, and that's what saves the day. Because you need that wrap up, but you can't have a female lead do that.
Exactly.
And
Yep, exactly.
I think historically that's one of the reasons why a lot of stories, if they did have a female and a male lead, it always looked like the female character was taking the secondary status, because in a way they were, because you couldn't have them dirty their hands.
Oh, that's an interesting point of view. So it's not out of some great patriarchal sexism that this is happening, or not only anyway. It's actually because the female character, to maintain the ideal, has to stay virtuous.
Yeah, it is basically sexism, but it's not the exact kind that people typically rail against. It's that weird, it's a weird byproduct. And that's why like you very seldom would see the female character administer the killing blow. Even though like I can think of a lot of like say B action movies where the female lead will recover the hero's special weapon and then throw it to him so he could finish off the bad guy. You're like, why don't you just go whack that thing yourself, woman? Just go. And I think that idea is so ingrained that this is why it's difficult. They can't get like female action heroes to take off, even though every year they try, and at best you get kind of like a limited success. And it's because it's that ideal that yeah, the female character to be the hero, to be strong, has to maintain that purity that having them kill the villain for revenge or that, it lessens their position. That they lose the moral high ground.
But what about, say, Wonder Woman? I mean, she kills the villain in that. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
No.
And that was a like big mega hit. And spoiler, she kills the villain, duh, at the end. I mean, so there are movies, and that being the most recent hit successful one with a female action lead where, Wonder Woman, she whacks the villain at the end.
Yeah, but that goes with that idea that I'm not necessarily saying that ideal portrayal, that is right or wrong. It's that's the dominant one because...
That's the dominant... Okay.
One of the reasons I think, say, like a decade or two ago, the Japanese stuff took off here is because it had high female readership.
Right.
And I think part of it is because people in general would not be opposed to the idea of, the female character finishes off the bad guy.
Right.
That... Because like we were saying before, a comic like Naruto, which is just the X-Men with ninjas instead of mutants, which the X-Men had for a long time, too, back in the 90s.
Yep.
Has 80s. Has a huge female readership, even though it's something we would ascribe to boy fiction, because girls like violence, too. But it's that ideal. And this is, again, anytime they've put forth an idea here, anytime they've tried to have like a female action lead, it's usually really ham-fisted and they try to play up that female side, which doesn't always work. And that was why, like I said, back in the 70s, you started having like female leads in comics, but there had to be at least one panel every issue where they explained that they didn't need a man. They were just as good as any male.
Right.
And it breaks the narrative. It seems weird and preachy sometimes, where if you just have the female character pick up a gun and hose down a bunch of guys like a male character would, I think everybody'd be okay with that.
Yeah. It's a weird cultural thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Even Wonder Woman kind of plays... They do a different trick with Wonder Woman. It's not a major spoiler or anything, but I noticed this while I was watching Wonder Woman, which is... They feminized all the main characters.
Okay.
By which I mean they feminized all the male characters. The male characters in Wonder Woman are almost all female archetypes. I noticed this when I was watching it, is that they basically play the roles that you would expect a female character to play in if we were to gender swap. Like if we were to gender swap Wonder Woman, almost nothing would change. It would play out like a typical male action story.
Right.
They basically masculinize Wonder Woman and they feminize all the male characters. And that's their solution to the problem.
But that might be a great way, because it was popular, and that might be it, because what you're doing is subconsciously all of the tropes that we're expecting are being fulfilled.
Yeah.
You're just doing it in a different way, but you're not leaving anything hanging. There's nothing that we're expecting that we're not getting.
Yes, exactly. So you're right. It's all there. It's just what they've done. And that is the one problem I've had with a lot, not all, but a lot of the female attempts at action heroes is a lot of them just read as they're men. It's just a woman playing the role. Going back to the classic, everyone harps to archetype of Ripley from Alien.
Right.
And Aliens, of course. Oh, an interesting note, that character was actually written, I believe, for a male. Sigourney Weaver just happened to get the role. Like, she literally just happened to end up being the person they thought, this is the best character, and having her play that really works, so let's do that. It's for Alien, of course. By Aliens, even then, her character is very masculine.
Right.
Like, she's got short hair, she's got the muscles, she literally comes across as a very masculine character. And they go out of their way to do that. And they masculinize her. Now, not that women can't act like men. I'm not saying women. But I do notice that the general solution to making a female action hero is to have her act like a man.
See, now I would put forth kind of, there might be a weird caveat to that. That what's happening is you're perceiving it backwards.
Okay.
That you're putting the female character in what's typically a male position.
Yes.
And it feels like you're masculining them up because of that. And because they're in the historically masculine position, they're not playing up the female tropes. But what's happened is you really haven't genderized it at all. It's just that because we're expecting one thing and getting something a little different, we're ascribing something to that that may or may not be there.
That's a valid point. That you're exactly a valid point. I may be misinterpreting it or looking at it from a perspective. Okay, yeah, I may be viewing it in there when it may not intentionally be there at all.
Yeah.
I think I could make a good case, though, that especially in the case of Ripley, and I think Wonder Woman, too, they really are giving them a lot of masculine traits purposely because they want the audience to view them as strong. Mm-hmm. And the idea in our culture is still the idea that strong in terms of like combat strength and everything else is still the realm of men.
Yeah.
And so I do think that there is some masculinization going on there. Perhaps I'm overestimating it, and that may be true, but I do think that there's definitely some happening there. Not that I going back to your point earlier, I'm not sure, though, what a truly female action hero would look like. Like one who is truly a woman. Mm-hmm. Like, and is still has those female traits, not the ones we associate with men.
Uh-huh.
But is still an action hero.
See, I think, again, too, this is where you start bumping into the idea that things aren't homogenous.
Mm.
Because I think it depends on who your audience is.
Okay.
And I think there's some play, like when you say action hero, there is some play back and forth with how you do things.
Right.
Because there's a movie, I can't remember what. Oh, Surf Nazis Must Die.
I think is okay.
It's a B movie. It's kind of a play on like the old like 70s exploitation films. And as I recall, isn't the hero in that like an old lady that just goes around killing all these guys?
I'm not sure because I've never actually watched it. I know of it, but I've never watched that one.
I'm pretty sure that's the one. And you can do things like that where you subvert it. And then what ends up happening is that people get into a character that really shouldn't work because it doesn't match our ideals at all.
Right.
But they're expecting subversion. It then works. And then sometimes that catches on and now you can kind of like fudge your way in.
Right.
And it creates like a new genre of action hero. And you can do stuff like that because, like I say, the definition is kind of fluid and it changes with eras.
Right, yeah. I can see that.
Like one of the problems I've had with North American films that try to have like a female action hero lead is a lot of times the actor they pick her for her looks.
Mm-hmm.
She's very attractive. Yes, and she has absolutely no willpower. Like, she doesn't project any kind of, like, personality at all. This is the kind of person that you expect when they get hit that they just start crying.
Right.
But I've seen, say, other countries that will do, like, a female action lead, and it works because they're not as hung up on getting the fashion model or whoever the popular singer is and squeezing them in. They'll actually pick an actor that has some force of personality.
Right. Actually, I think I do know what, from my perspective, and again, this is just mine, what a female action lead should be more like.
Uh-huh.
I think that usually the Asians tend to get it right in that, for example, in a Chinese movie, for example, the female action lead will usually be one who, rather than relies on strength, is more one based on, you know, outthinking their opponents, is more strategic, and usually is more based on, like, dexterity. And is more based on nimbleness, that kind of thing.
Right.
But not based on direct confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, from my perspective, is I think the more female archetype for an action hero. One who deals with their problems by moving around them and controlling the situation rather than directly confronting it, which is a more typically male approach to things.
Yeah, but it kind of depends too, because this is what I've always said happened in Japan. When you got to, say, going into the early 80s, they had that weird side effect with their nerdly entertainment that they realized, right. And I'm doing finger quotes, that if you made the quote-unquote hot chick the main character, you could show more of her. But as a byproduct, you ended up with shitloads of female action leads and all kinds of different stuff because people just got used to that idea, whereas in North America, for a long time, that was something that was still a little weird to us.
Well, that's true. Okay, that's fair enough.
Because they'll do that. That was our joke back in the day, like when we first started trading tapes with guys in Japan. You'd be like, oh, fight scene. Giggling teenage girl, that guy is so fucking dead. He's not yeah, making it right. to the commercial.
Yeah.
And then that's where I say you can kind of subvert things, because you do that, it's weird, people like it because it's weird and different, and then after like a decade of it, it's not weird and different, it's the standard, and you've changed the trope.
Yes and no. I mean, even with the Japanese stuff, as someone who, again, has consumed more than a fair share of it, the female characters tend to win because of skill, not power. It's still ultimately, usually they're winning because they're outthinking their opponent. Occasionally, there are ones who, like Sailor Moon, who are winning basically because of power. Mm. I admit, yes, that's true. Mostly, again, the willpower.
Yeah.
She wins because of willpower and focus. She's not winning because of sheer strength, so to speak. That usually isn't how it's done. Usually. Again, not always. I mean, again, and I'm not saying any of this is required. Even when I say, you know, my version of, you know, what I think a female action hero should be like, again, it's just my take on what I think works from my perceptions. I don't think it's the only way to do it. I think it's perfectly reasonable to have a female action hero who is just, you know, very strong and powerful and absolutely kick ass. I mean, that's totally reasonable. Again, these are fantasy characters, so why not? I mean, you can do it however you want. Although, again, as you pointed out, the Japanese version tends to be this, like, tiny giggly schoolgirl who's going up against this huge mammoth person who, yeah, in real life, it just does not work that way. But again, this is a fantasy, so therefore, it can happen however you want it to.
No, I think back to one of the most badass people I ever met was my grandmother, and she maybe weighed 60 pounds.
Again, willpower and determination and skill.
No, well, skill. Especially if she had a knife, she'd cut you 20 times before you hit the dirt.
Well, again, skill. We'll go with that. But she's not. But she wasn't winning like arm wrestling competitions with people.
No, I saw her do that once.
Really?
Yeah. It might have been just willpower. But
I think that was willpower. It was... I saw your grandmother. I'm pretty sure that was willpower. Your grandmother, as you said, was a stick.
Mm-hmm.
That's just willpower, dude. That's not, you know, bulk or sheer force or anything like that. That's willpower. And she had a lot of that.
And this is why I think for myself personally, why, like, I think a lot of the female action heroes in North America didn't work, because they don't convey that.
I agree with you on that. I agree 100%. I mean, our idea of strength, part of it is just an actor that's capable of conveying that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they very, very often choose the wrong actor or actress, as the case may be, to do that job. And I think that happens with a lot of male action heroes too.
Yeah. Cause it's, you shoehorn whoever the current popular guy is.
And yeah. And that's usually why they fail.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So we should probably bring this to a close then.
Okay.
So any final thoughts on the subject of strength?
I think when it comes to our North American ideals of strength and portrayals, what it looks like happened is we always attribute strength to the individual, but we redefine what the individual is at, with different eras.
Interesting. Okay. So it is still always the rugged individual, but what that means changes over time.
Yeah. And that's where, like I said, nowadays we see... the organization is an affectation of the individual. So it's individual as group, but we're still focusing all of the effort and value on the individual.
Okay. I think that's a good takeaway from this, actually. I know that this conversation has kind of wandered all over the place and seemed a little bit rambling, but I hope we kind of managed to bring it around in the end. And I think a lot of it does fit together. You, the audience, may agree or disagree. You can leave your thoughts at obeythedna.com. Come and comment on our website and let us know what you think. What does strong mean? What does weak mean? How does our media portray it? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Let us know. Until then, signing out, it's Rob Patterson and Don Chisholm. Good night, folks.
Good luck.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you'd like to hear more or join the conversation, come visit us at obeythedna.com. You can also find us on iTunes or whatever fine podcast site forgot to lock their back door. So until next time, remember that to master the nerdly arts takes time, practice, and enough Coca-Cola to drop a rhino. See ya!